Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. We are, as we often do, coming to you live, sort of, from Atlanta, Georgia, the home of Coca-Cola, which is a controversial company. It's one of the largest plastic polluters in the world, according to several recent studies. It's also responsible for our cultural image of Santa Claus in the West. It's also responsible for popularizing polar bears in a very endearing way. Hi, I'm Ben.
Hey, Ben. I'm Noel. Basically, Coca-Cola invented Santa Claus, essentially, for all intents and purposes, right?
The visual of it, yeah.
Yeah, isn't that
crazy? Mm-hmm.
I think that's just bonkers, like how far-reaching marketing is. Like it just like a company that old has the power to literally change the course of like the zeitgeist and the way people view a mythological figure.
That's what I love about the Coca-Cola Museum. They're transparent about it. Mm-hmm. They're pretty much like, this was Santa Claus beforehand, and then we got involved.
That's right. When was the last time you went to the Coca-Cola Museum, Ben?
Oh, it's been a number of years. They've done some extensive retrofitting, or renovations, rather.
Have they?
Yeah. When's the last time you went?
Well, I think I went on a school trip when I was a kid. I just remember there's the room where you can taste all of the Coke products from around the world.
At the very end. And the worst one, for anyone who hasn't been there yet, the worst one is an Italian digestif called Beverly.
What does it taste like?
It tastes like crime, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
And punishment?
It's a crime in your mouth.
Okay. Is it sort of like a Malort or like, an herbal kind of vibe?
Yeah, I think it's an herbal vibe. It's not a digestif. It's an aperitif.
I see.
So turn that on its head.
And is it fizzy?
Yeah, it's carbonated. It's a soft drink. An aperitif is something you drink before a meal to help you digest, right? It has been described as tasting of grapefruit rind, leaning into the bitter.
That's what Malort tastes like.
Oh, okay.
Malort is like the famous Chicago liqueur.
Oh, yeah. I know that stuff.
People love it in Chicago, and it's sort of like a rite of passage for folks visiting or folks moving there to try it. And it's very grapefruity, but like absurdly heavy on the bitter.
Tell you someone else that Chicago loves. That's our super producer, Casey Pegram.
And he loves Chicago.
I love the deep dish pizza.
Yeah, it's good.
Like I said, pizza.
Yeah, pizza. Because you're a Southern boy.
Do you really
it
like
came out there.
Deep dish pizza?
Probably just because, you know, I only end up in Chicago once every decade or so. Uh-huh. So that's a pretty good pace for the deep dish, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know?
I mean, I genuinely enjoy it, but I couldn't eat it like all the time if I lived there.
Oh, no. It would kill you. Your heart would explode.
Yeah.
What's the best deep dish pizza in Chicago?
I had a Luminalde, Lou something.
Yeah.
I had Giordano's. Giordano's is what I had.
Giordano's is well known.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had that before.
Chicago listeners, write in. Tell us your favorite Chicago deep dish pizza joint. We were dying to know.
Philly listeners, write in and tell me your favorite Philly cheesesteak. I feel way more comfortable asking people not on stage. Asking from the safety of a studio.
I 100% agree. But we're not talking about cheesesteaks, nor deep dish pizzas, nor Chicago. We let off talking about Coca-Cola. We talked a little bit about Santa Claus, buried the lead a bit with polar bears.
Yeah, that's where I was setting us up. Yeah, polar bears. So if you are in the West and familiar with things like TVs or advertisements, then you have probably seen the famous Coca-Cola polar bear. It's very prominent 3D animation now, but the polar bear actually dates back to 1922. It's a very old Coca-Cola ad, and their advertising is super effective. Oddly enough, around the time this was being invented, Coca-Cola was not alone in their obsession with polar bears. It turns out that across the pond in Germany, the German people for several decades, had an obsession with polar bears themselves. Not just polar bears, but specifically dudes wearing polar bear costumes.
Yeah, and just really quickly, the first advertisement featuring the Coca-Cola polar bear, or at least one of from 1922, as you said, is a polar bear sitting kind of on his back haunches in a ice mound with some Coca-Colas on ice in said mound. And he or she is feeding, dare I say, squirting a bottle of Coke into the mouth of the sun.
Right, which Megan Thee Stallion would, for any hip-hop fans, would call driving the boat.
Is that a thing?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So when you pour a drink into someone's mouth?
Yeah, from what I could tell, it's when that MC pours shots into people's mouths, and it's become a thing. Casey, are you aware of this?
I am not aware of this.
Okay, well, maybe we're not plugged in enough. But yes, yeah, it's very, for anybody who's a fan of hip-hop, look up that poster Noel described. I think the one we found is in French, but it's very much the picture. You did a great job describing that.
So that's one of the reasons that this whole polar bear obsession hit. Another one, possibly the more close-to-home reason, was that in the 1920s, there was a family of polar bears, live polar bears, that were sent to the Berlin Zoo. And folks got really jazzed about it. And the zoo decided they wanted to really lean into this. And so they dressed up a man in a polar bear suit and had him, you know, pose like you do. They're like at the Atlanta Aquarium, they've got a person in a penguin suit because the penguins are a big attraction there. But you would get these commemorative photos. And these things were like printing money because at the time, folks didn't really have their own cameras. They weren't portable. Right. So to get one of these photographs was kind of a big deal.
And photography was experiencing a tremendous moment here in the interwar years of Germany. There were cabarets, so many amazing automobile races, and so on. And people posing with polar bears, fake or real, was part of this. I like that you point out that there was not the proliferation of photographic technology that we are so fortunate to experience today. Instead, people would go to a professional photographer. Having a camera at this point was a way to make a living. Just possessing that technology could gain you entry into a livelihood. What's weird about these polar bear photos is that it went beyond the zoo, right? It makes sense for people to get a photograph of the mascot or maybe the actual polar bears in the background. But soon enough, these photos began proliferating outside of the zoo, and there were no set patterns. You would see people in swimsuits on the beach and then some dude in a polar bear costume with them, a polar bear with people at fancy parties or hanging with the military. And it went across all demographics, all classes, generations, and so on. It's weird because most of these photos, and you can see several examples online, most of these photos are not only black and white, but they're close up. So it's kind of difficult to guess exactly where they were taken, but we have some clues.
And we have some lovely firsthand accounts that we are getting from a blog called GermanGirlInAmerica.com of a young woman recounting some of her memories as a child. And this was something that was very much part of that experience. Her name is Karen Ann, by the way. I recommend checking out her blog. Lots of cool stuff about German culture and history. And it's true. They became very popular attractions at vacation destinations, resorts in a town called Kerr, were very popular, and a gentleman by the name of Carl Bitterling in Rügen created his own version of this in his photography studio that was specifically set up to stage these polar bear photographs for folks that were there on holiday. And he would get about 5 marks per one of these photo setups. And that was no chump change at the time.
Right. And what I love about this blog is that our author goes on to say, especially for notoriously frugal Germans. I guess you can say that, GermanGirlInAmerica.com. I don't know if we can. I don't know if I feel comfortable going to a European stereotype. But I do feel comfortable exploring the weird history of Coca-Cola. It's very much from our native land. So we have that first theory about the zoo, right? And the pair of polar bears that come to this German zoo. We have this other theory that you can see proposed in a number of different places that says these polar bear outfits, this craze came out of an advertising campaign for Fanta. As you know, Fanta was created as a replacement soda during World War II because there were Coca-Cola syrup shortages in Germany.
I did not know that.
Well, Fanta is made from apple fiber and a couple of other fruit syrups that were easier to get together. Let's look at the timeline. As we said at the top, Coca-Cola used a polar bear for ads back in 1922, and Fanta wanted people to think of Fanta when they think of Coca-Cola. So they asked the Stief Company to make a polar bear costume, and the bear would pose with regular people doing regular things, and it became this sort of reminder of what life after wartime could be. Things could be normal again. And then, of course, because people connect Coca-Cola with a polar bear, they see a polar bear and they see a Fanta, you know, logo or can, and then they associate the two. And all of a sudden, Fanta becomes like a stand-in for Coke. That was their mission.
And it's funny, we think of Fanta in the States as pretty exclusively orange. An orange drink.
There's a grape Fanta, too.
That's right. But yeah, when I think of Fanta, I typically think of orange soda. Mm. And it wasn't that. That's not where its roots began at all.
What's that other orange soda?
Crush?
Maybe that's it.
Slice?
Maybe, yeah, yeah. There were a few.
Yeah.
There were a few orange sodas.
I really like Orangina.
Yeah. I was mispronouncing it for a year or two.
How could you possibly have mispronounced
that? My girlfriend didn't tell me.
Oh, she was trolling you, Ben.
This was an ex, but we didn't break up due to the my mispronunciation of Orangina. I'm not going to give the mispronunciation on the air, but you all know what I was accidentally saying.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of segues, 1933. All right, we're talking about the interwar years in Germany. And even if we talk about something as cute and innocuous as polar bears, we all know who's going to show up. That's right, Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah, he's always lurking just around the corner in these cute stories. In 1933, when the Nazis assumed power, a man by the name of Max Keitt, spelled like Keith but pronounced Kite, he took over the German subsidiary of Coca-Cola, and he decided to score some points with, you know, the Nazis by really leaning into Coca-Cola as like a lifestyle thing and emphasizing this German way of life, which of course included Nazi rule.
Aryanism, all that jazz. Yeah, and here's the thing. Back in the States, the Coca-Cola company, which was led by Robert Woodruff at the time, did not discourage this at all. They kind of tacitly approved of it. And we're getting some of this information from a fantastic Atlas Obscura article called How Fanta Was Created for Nazi Germany by Matthew Blitz. I cannot say enough good things about Atlas Obscura. I love it. They've got a hardback out. I bought the hardback. It's great. It's great reading.
Really, really great site.
So here's what goes down. As we know, history buffs, on December 7th, 1941, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. The U.S. enters World War II. And when the U.S. enters World War II, that means that legally speaking, all American companies have to cut all business activities with the enemies, with Germany. So Coca-Cola headquarters here in Atlanta followed the letter of the law. They cut off communications with Mr. Keitt in Germany, and they stopped exporting their 7X flavoring. And the flavoring is like this syrup, right? And you add the carbonation and the water later when you're making a Coke.
And that is the famous secret ingredient, supposedly like only a couple of executives have it.
They can't be on the plane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They can't be on the same plane at the same time.
I think that's accurate. That's right. But yeah, so I mean, basically, Coca-Cola GmbH is what it was called, was left cold. And there was the threat of the Nazis actually seizing, taking control of the company. But he had a brilliant idea that just might save his company. Because, again, it's a subsidiary, right? So it's like a franchise kind of? Or how would you consider that? I mean, obviously, they were working in league with the Americans, but he was sort of independent.
And there was probably some licensing fees that he paid, right? But the infrastructure, the factory, the bottling apparatus and so on, that's technology that is now solely in his possession until the Nazi Party nationalizes it. And just because the businesses have cut ties, it doesn't mean that these factories or this manufacturing capacity goes away. So here's what Keitt does. It's pretty clever. He gets together with his chemists, his eggheads and stuff, and he says, let's take what we can find here in the midst of this horrible war, and let's try to, using those ingredients and those constraints, let's try to get as close to Coke as we can in terms of taste. Here's what they were left with, though. This is a story of ingenuity. There's some MacGyver action going on here. They essentially took the leftovers of other food manufacturers. So fruit shavings, leftover apple fibers and pulp, beet sugar, even a cheese byproduct. Did you see that part?
Ugh, that gives me the willies.
You're not into cheese soda?
Not into cheese soda. And this is, we teased this earlier in the episode, but this was the makings of Fanta. And he got that from the shorthand for the German word for fantasy. And it did quite well. So Fanta was, from the very beginning, a German invention.
And even though he was doing this in step with the Nazi Party, after the end of World War II, here in Atlanta, Mr. Keitt was hailed as a hero from across the Atlantic because he had kept the fires burning for Coca-Cola in Germany.
How do you think that worked with profits at the time?
You know, I think they were just glad that the factory didn't get bombed.
I think that's probably
you
true.
Know what I mean?
And they had somewhere to start back over once the war ended and the Nazis were defeated.
It would be really tough to be an accountant for an international corporation at that time, you know?
Oh, I can only imagine.
So Coke's VP of sales at the time is a fellow named Harrison Jones. And Harrison Jones is over the moon about Mr. Keitt. And he says, you know, he's a great man. Who knows how he did it? He operated in the trenches. He is our pick. He shouldn't just be in charge of this company in Germany. He should be in command of all of Coca-Cola in Europe.
Yeah, it's true. And that original recipe, which obviously was made in dire circumstances, you know, under duress with kind of whatever they could get their hands on, decided not to stick with the cheese beet juice soda, and they went for what we now know as the orange Fanta, which is kind of just classic Fanta, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it made a huge splash in Italy and then came to the U.S. in 1958.
Yep. Apparently, they revived the name Fanta because it was already kind of a sunk cost, you know, that we'd already put in the legwork. I say we. By we, I mean the company that was doing this way before I was born. They had already had name recognition, which is one of the toughest, most important things to get. And Coca-Cola, of course, already had the copyright. So this polar bear that's showing up in the pre-wartime Coca-Cola ads and this polar bear that's showing up in the German interwar and wartime ads, it becomes this symbol for the aspirational non-wartime life. You know what I mean? Even though there's death and destruction and fire raining down from the sky, people get this comfort of warm, fuzzy feeling when they pose with a drink and a furry friend, whether a real polar bear or honestly a dude in costume. I don't know if you guys ever saw this. I may have sent it to you before. One of my favorite ad campaigns of the past several years is for an Egyptian cheese. It's like made alahesh. I can't remember what it's called. It's panda cheese. And the commercials are a series of vignettes where there's a incredibly violent panda. Have you seen these?
No.
I got to send them. They're going to make your day. Also, Eden will love them because they're that kind of anti-humor that the young folks dig.
Oh, yeah. She's definitely got that absurdist sense of humor for sure.
So this polar bear, I know we got a little sidetracked into the story of Fanta, but don't worry. We are getting back to the polar bear. And here's how. Because, you see, it turns out that we as a species were very close to completely forgetting The mysterious trend of polar bear photos in Germany. In fact, this may have been lost to history entirely were it not for a single French photo collector.
Yeah, a man by the name of Jean-Marie Donat. Casey?
Yeah, it'd be Jean-Marie Donat.
Ah, Casey on the case. But I did an okay job to start with. But I still did pretty well. It's nice to have confirmation.
Like Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify.
Indeed. So this photo collector started coming across these images. There were tons of them. Photos taken on the streets all around Germany, particularly in the capital of Berlin. And he was fascinated by just how strange this whole phenomenon was and wanted to know why, you know, what was going on here that led to this. So he knew there was a bigger story and he collected these photos in a book called Teddy Bear. Teddy Bear, because it's an umlaut over the A, so it's Teddy Bear.
So it sounds like an IKEA product.
It absolutely does. And Ben, we were talking a little bit off air about how kind of terrifying and surreal these photos are.
Didn't age well. It's weird because I'm really into it, and strange we're doing an audio podcast about this bear. The bear costumes all look sort of similar, but the thing that makes it weird, I think, is that the bear has beady little eyes. Clearly, the person wearing the costume is seen out of the mouth or maybe just under the jaw, and the bear's mouth is always open with these prominent fangs. So it's got, like, dead Kirsten Dunst eyes, and it's got this cavernous, carnivorous mouth.
What do you have against Kirsten Dunst eyes?
Nothing. I just think they're dead eyes.
Really?
You know? Yeah, I don't think there's much feeling in
I've
them.
I've never heard that said before. I'll have to take a look next time I watch one of her movies.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's a great thing for an actor, especially in Interview with a Vampire.
That's true. That's true. She was a creepy vampire child. But no, there are dozens of these photos, and I highly recommend. There's an article on Vice called Polar Bears and Blackface. Jean-Marie Donat has collected over 10,000 creepy old photos. Actually, Jean-Marie Donat is interviewed for this piece.
Right. Yeah. And I would say the polar bear photos or that collection, I would say that's definitely the more comfortable of the two.
Agreed.
Because blackface has such a, is, you know, blackface is an atrocity.
So, of course. But it's also a really interesting snapshot of Germany during a really surreal and strange transitional period. Like some of these photos, for example, there's one here I'm seeing with two Nazi SS officers posing with a quite horrific bear. Reminds me of the dude in the dog costume in The Shining a little bit.
Yeah, there's also pictures of children wearing Nazi regalia. There's one with a girl who's sitting on a polar bear's lap, sort of the way kids would sit on Santa's lap or the Easter Bunny's lap. And also, I have to wonder, too, am I the only one who thinks that all of those old photos with animal costumes are creepy? I haven't seen one that doesn't look creepy. Like, have you ever seen the old 1950s pictures of the Easter Bunny?
Yeah.
Horrific.
Yeah, or even just Halloween costumes in general. They look very demonic and like the kind of thing you'd see in like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something. It's very, very, very unsettling stuff.
And this book, which is a tome, it's 200 pages. It shows the bears with everyone that we had mentioned, including the Nazi soldiers and stuff. And the time frame of the book goes from about the 1920s to the 1960s. There's also a think piece from a philosopher named Klaus-Peter Spedel who adds some context to this. And he says that, well, it's weird. He does sort of a thought exercise is probably the best way to describe it, where he tries to imagine the perspective of the people in the costumes, these German interwar Elmos. That's kind of what they were. You know what I mean? Like if you go to Times Square in New York, there are all these sketchy, it's almost a trope here. There are sketchy Elmos that will come up to you, maybe smelling of booze or maybe just trying to support their acting careers, and they'll try to get a picture with you and charge you for it.
Yeah, and some of the folks that are in these costumes are really leaning into like the I am a polar bear vibe, and they're actually crawling on all fours and doing that kind of grr tiger hand, you know what I mean, that whole thing. Some of these are very, very strange and disturbing images, but again, such a fascinating look into this time period and this history.
So we have one big question, though. Whether it started due to Fanta or whether it started due to the polar bears at the zoo, I bet both played a role. why did it stick around for almost half a century? Like, why did the polar bear thing become a thing? And then why did it die when it did?
I don't know. Germans just in general are really fond of a good gimmick. You know, they have a hard time letting it go. Again, from that wonderful German Girl in America blog. First of all, I love this. Polar bear in German is Eisbär. E-I-S-B-A umlaut R. And by the way, one of those famous polar bears at the Berlin Zoo, who was absolutely beloved, was Knut the polar bear, who sadly died of a mysterious autoimmune disease that has only been known to occur in humans. And this was only just recently solved in 2011.
Yeah, people identified with these creatures and anthropomorphized them to no small degree. And so that was part of it, this comfort, right? Who doesn't want to be friends with a cool Ursus maritimus, which is the scientific name for polar bear?
I love that. And it's so crazy how we can kind of track this, especially thanks to the exhaustive work done by our photo collector friend, Donat. The last dated photo that we have of someone posing with a polar bear was at an Oktoberfest from 1962, because this trend kind of faded away.
And while we cannot concretely, definitively trace the death of the polar bear photo trend to a single cause, we do have one very, very good guess, and it goes back to technology. Just like we said in the beginning, cameras were very uncommon. They were not a thing that the average person would have in their wallet or in their satchel or their stick and bindle, their valise. I'm just naming old containers. They wouldn't have a camera in there. Cameras were specialized gear for a certain trade. But by the 1960s, cameras are becoming more and more common. People have their own cameras. They don't have to pay for souvenirs, you know? So now these novelty photograph studios are having a tougher time. Why would I pay 3 to 5 marks to stand next to a polar bear when I have my own camera? I can just take a picture of the kids and the spouse by myself.
That's absolutely true. And I think one thing that is interesting to talk about is the whole, you know, people really have strong feelings about zoos one way or the other. I tend to be more okay with them if the animals couldn't survive in the wild, which I have been told is the case at the Atlanta Zoo for most of the animals that are there. But apparently, according to the German Animal Welfare Association, polar bears shouldn't be kept in zoos at all, largely because of how far they like to travel.
Right. Polar bears have a huge, huge range, a huge territory, and that's how they evolved to survive. Do you want to know what I think about zoos?
Tell me.
Vampire rules. You have to invite me in, and you have. So some people call zoos animal jail. That's something that I've heard. Here at the Atlanta Zoo, they do a lot of good work, but there's a price to pay. So the merchandise and stuff that they'll sell at a lot of Western zoos goes directly into conservation efforts. Mm-hmm. For a time, I don't know if this is true anymore, but for a time, the population of tigers in captivity in Texas was larger than the population of tigers in the wild across the planet.
Oh, wow.
So wild animals may very well be a thing of the past by the time you have grandchildren, and you may be telling your grandkids, you know, once I saw a bear in the woods, or I saw a turkey and it was a jerk, and they'll be like, what, an animal just walking around?
That's
get out of here.
Yeah.
Get out of here. That's like typing with your hands. It's an old myth. And we do need zoos, but there are also a lot of great conservationist organizations. Polar bears are a special case because they're not only adapted or acclimated to a huge swath of territory, it's also a specific kind of territory. You know what I mean? Like, we can take an animal that's used to a more temperate climate and put it in a reserve, a preserve of some sort, right? And it will adapt more easily than something that was bred to be out in the wastelands of the frozen north. It's a shame. You know, one interesting thing that is happening, though, with polar bears?
No, tell me.
They're breeding with grizzly bears. As
what?
Yeah, they're hybrid. Look it up.
What do they become, beige?
Yeah, it's they're called Pizzlies. P-I-Z-Z-L-Y.
That's adorable.
Polar grizzlies. They're huge, and they kind of look like they have ombre. You know, the hair thing where an ombre is like a hair thing where the, I guess the hair is lighter or darker. I'm not a cosmetologist. I don't know, man. They look like they have weird highlights. Look it up. It's interesting. They kind of, if you wanted to be negative, you could say they look like dirty polar bears.
Yeah. I don't think that's negative. It's like dirty blonde.
There we go. There we go. What's the difference between dirty blonde and strawberry blonde? I don't know.
I think strawberry blonde's got a little bit more of a highlight, like a fiery highlight to it. And dirty blonde is a little more beige blonde.
Interesting. Well, today I learned something.
We all did, hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully we ended on a not too down note, Pizzlies. This ends our episode, but not our show. We want to hear about more strange trends. So just to recap on the things we asked to hear from you about today, we had several. Deep dish pizza in
Chicago.
Deep
dish pizza in Chicago.
Philly cheesesteaks in Philadelphia.
Preferably.
And we want to hear also about the strange historical trends that you have found that may have been lost to the modern day. Polar bears in Germany. Had no idea that was a thing.
Same. You can write to us at ridiculous@iheartradio.com. You can hit us up on social media where we're Ridiculous History on Instagram. And you can join our Facebook group, Ridiculous Historians. Additionally, you can find us as individual human people on the social media. I am exclusively on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
You can find me sipping on my branded Ridiculous History coffee mug.
Which you can get at tpublic.com/ridiculous history.
Right. You can find me doing this on my own personal Instagram in between bouts of getting kicked into and kicked out of various countries, communities, and regions. I am in a burst of creativity at Ben Bolin. You can also find me on Twitter where I am at Ben Bolin HSW. The HSW stands for How Stuff Works. Big, big thanks to Casey Pegram. Casey, I can see you in the studio today. That's pretty cool.
We got this window situation happening.
Nice.
Got that direct eye contact, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. We're spoiled. Thanks also to... Oh, man. I forgot.
Yeah.
It's time, gentlemen.
Can't believe we almost made it to the end.
Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. the Quister.
It's past time, you jerks.
It's been
just
a
trying
while.
Just trying to barrel through it now, are you?
What are you implying? That we, like, invite you to do this?
This is... I'm implying...
That you don't just manifest?
I'm implying I'm sitting at the same table, and you're just thinking, well, if we just put our noses down, surely, and don't give him an opportunity, there's no way, but Casey has the hookup. He has the button that plays the Quister sound effect. Do it again, Casey.
That's all put in post. You know this, right?
Don't destroy the illusion.
LaBouche is playing both sides. I see you, man. I see you. This eye contact studio is a dangerous thing. Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, it has been quite some time. We had a streak where for one reason or another, you weren't showing up. You did not deign to grace us with your presence.
We were frequently in different time zones, yes. and now we are all together. And because of that, there's this sea of humanity within this increasingly stuffy studio. We're going to have a Quister segment, the most cringeworthy segment in all of podcasting, whereupon I give you a historical scenario, and you two have 3 minutes to determine whether or not said scenario is in fact a real historical fact, or if I made it up, sees. And also, as always, we have to have an arbitrary rule in the case that either of you have a question for me where you want some clarification.
I have a question. Are you the reason these studios are stuffy? That's the kind of low-level mischief I wouldn't put past you.
I will say that I've been through the entire process where this studio was like a deep freezer and then became stuffy, and the other studio, the Stuff You Should Know studio, did the opposite. So apparently if one studio is going to be stuffy, the other one is an ice box.
Right. I would describe the thermostats in these rooms as ornamental. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They look good.
Yes, I would call the ductwork arbitrary, which is why I love it so much. Well, let me give you the scenario, then I will give you your arbitrary rule.
Okay.
And as I recall, today you were talking about photography. And polar bears.
Yes, that's correct.
Excellent.
And thank you for pronouncing that correctly.
You're welcome. So we're going to have a photography-related historical fact. Here you are.
All right.
If you were to look at old photographs from the very early days of photography, you'd notice something peculiar. Some of those images appear to have both children and ghosts in them. Not orbs floating around or transparent figures looming in the background, but rather the classic sheet ghost. Now, this was due to a superstition that children would be extremely susceptible to having their spirits affected by the strange process of photography. So, to distract any potential malicious forces, an adult would pose in the photo as well, ostensibly to attract the evil attention toward them instead of the children. But because the goal was to capture the photographs of the children, not the adults would attempt to hide themselves under sheets and throws so as not to pull focus, so to speak, from the children themselves.
Oof. Your accent is really wandering today.
Well, so do I. So that is your scenario, and of course your arbitrary rule is that if you wish to ask a question, you have to precede it with, "Can you picture that?" from the Muppet movie. Begin the timer.
Hang on. This is going to take me a second because the grandfather clock's in the other room.
Yeah, this. So Noel.
Yes.
How's it going?
It's been better.
Yeah. No, I hear you, man. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you have to be you, you know?
I know. And plus, on top of that, this coffee machine we have now.
Ugh, it's the worst.
Is the worst.
Okay, guys, ready?
Yeah, then do it.
Okay, now.
You must wait. What? What's the rule?
Can you picture that?
Can you picture that?
Yes. No.
What was the actual query?
The query is this in fact a real thing that happened where photography
spook deflection?
Children and adults underneath these sheets posing together with the purpose of the adults being there to pull the evil, malicious, potential spirits toward them instead of toward the children.
Or pull focus, as you could not stop yourself from saying.
Wait, so they're ghosts? They're the ghost? There's also a ghost in the picture?
It's just a person underneath a sheet. It looks like a ghost. If we were to look at the photographs in a series, if we had a scrapbook of these photographs and we were to flip through them, we'd say, why are all these Victorian children posing with Charlie Brown-style ghosts?
I see.
So it's another photographic trend. Mm-hmm. If this is true.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm still confused about, you said the children are hiding under sheets too?
No, the adults are hiding under the sheets. The children are posing.
So the adults are the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I see.
And they're supposed to be kind of a paranormal lightning rod, right?
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of putting it. I should have written that part down.
No, don't worry about it, man. I'm just pretty great.
Next time.
And humble. Mm. So,
I don't like it, Ben.
Yeah, I don't like it either. I do want to real quick give a shout out to our friend on Ridiculous Historians who actually added up the tally.
Yes, I believe it's 1310.
1310.
Quizster.
Yeah, I'm aware, Jonathan. Hang on, let me find the name of the guy real quick. Let us know. We can't dig through the thread right now because we're on this 3-minute timer. But let us know who you are so we can give you a shout out on air. Someone did go back through and add this up. We're 3 behind. We also have 53 seconds to go here.
I stand by not liking it. You want to know why?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It just seems kind of arbitrary and made up. And like he saw the episode we were doing and just sort of like made up a similar scenario.
Well, he just saw the summary. That's why I didn't send him, like, all of our notes.
What is your gut, Ben? What is your gut?
You know, I'm tempted to say true, but I'm very, like, at this point, I don't know. I'm so shell-shocked he actually showed up again.
I know. Me too. I thought we were done with him.
All right. You want to rock, paper, scissors for it?
Let's do it.
You're false, I'm true. One, yep. Two, three, shoot. All right. One, two, three, shoot.
This is good audio.
One, two, three, shoot. Okay, so we're going with false.
The coin flip situation. You're so incredibly confident of your answer. You're right. As it turns out, it is in fact false. However,
These
photographs do exist. There are photographs of Victorian children posing with adults who are underneath sheets, but it was not to pull focus of some malicious spiritual force.
So there's the lie, is the motivation.
Exactly, because why this was happening is that, you remember in old photography, the exposure time for a camera was incredibly long, which
right,
is
you had
why
to, you had to sit perfectly still.
And that's why you don't see people smiling in those old photographs, because holding a smile that long is unnerving and unsettling at best.
Untrue. They were just gangster. The smile was not invented until 1974. Well, everyone knows that.
Also, to another thing
by
that
Coca-Cola
everyone knows
company.
Is that children are little tiny brats, and they squirm like crazy all the time. So in an effort to keep the children from moving like crazy during a sitting for a photograph, the adults would sometimes hide themselves underneath a sheet to act as a reassuring presence toward the child for the process of photography. There's actually an entire photographic display called Hidden Mothers, where it's moms who have a sheet draped over them as if they are a chair or perhaps an armoire.
A chaise lounge.
An ottoman from the Empire, perhaps.
Right.
And the child is posing right next to them. So now we are at 13:11.
Yeah, we're two down. And I hope you don't regret showing up to hand us this victory.
This was a fun one. I enjoyed learning about the hidden mothers. And so I was I debated on whether or not to give you the real reason, but I thought, that one's, it's so mundane.
I was, that's where I think that's where I was misled, because I knew that there was this trend, but I was not certain of the motivation. Mm-hmm. Authoritative, you say reassuring, but I think we both know is an authoritative presence to keep them standing still. But be that as it may, win or lose, it's always a pleasure / disaster to have you on the show, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quizster. It looks like we're coming back. You know what I mean? We may be able to turn this around.
Yeah, and feel free to come back again, sooner than later to give us a chance to evenly score.
Mm. Oh, yeah, now we've got the taste of victory, so now we no longer hate and fear this segment.
Exactly.
So you're telling me to bring it.
Yes. Bring it on.
Noted.
Mm-hmm. I think we made it almost all the way through. We made it through the social media bits, but let's start.
Let's see, we thanked Casey.
Did we thank Casey? And that's when everything went
south. Yeah.
Big thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Thanks, Jonathan. Christopher Asiotis here in spirit, not a ghostly presence, but more of a. He's sort of like Mufasa in The Lion King.
He gave us a cool lead on exploding muffins recently. Mm. Thanks also to Yves Jeffcoat. Thanks to Gabe Luzier, our research associate, who has such a good nose for good stories.
He absolutely does. Thanks to the Coca-Cola Company. Thanks to anthropomorphized polar bears the world over. Love to see that trend come back. Maybe we could bring it back. What do you say?
Yeah, I'm in. Let's do it.
I got a friend who was in one of those polar bear outfits.
Tight.
Mm.
See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.